We have a full schedule this afternoon as we talk about Christian counseling in the church. What an exciting challenge we have, and what an important part of this conference. I have been thinking about this as I prepared by trying to understand something about the church in Australia. One of the little magazines that I encountered was a magazine called World Christian. And several months ago, they had an article on Australia. It was written by a man who is an Australian. So whenever I tell you here, you can blame it on a fellow Australian. But he was describing a little bit what Australia was like and what the church is like in Australia, so foreigners like me would understand something about the culture. I found his article to be very interesting. Let me share with you just some excerpts. It's time to stop for afternoon tea.
Excuse me, Gary. It's not time to stop for afternoon tea, but I thought I'd better get you before you got too far in the introduction. Okay. We've got an urgent phone call for Jen Stenton. If she could see us at the back of the hall, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. This article is very interesting because it describes a little bit about what Australia is like. Let me describe what your fellow countrymen. You want to know who it is? It's a man by the name of John Dalton, who is founder and director of the Brisbane Centre for World Missions. Is he here? I'm quoting this man. It comes from somebody who lives in Brisbane, so it must be right. He says Australia... Oh, he makes the comment, incidentally, that one Time magazine poll in the United States showed that at least 8 million Americans are seriously considering settling in Australia. So you better do something about that, or you're going to be overrun by foreigners who talk like I do. Then he makes this statement: Australia is a land attached to the West by language and history, but to Asia geographically and increasingly in trade. And that probably is true, as I was just looking at the business section of the paper today. This is not the typical Western addiction. There is not the typical Western addiction to haste, efficiency, expansion, and work. When I came here, I was told, you can relax, Gary. You don't have to get all dressed up. I said, do I need to wear a suit? Somebody said they wouldn't recognize you if you wore a suit. But he says Australia is much more casual, much slower, and sometimes fatalistic. Probably no other nation has an unofficial national anthem like Australia's. In contrast to the proud strains of the American, English, and French, or we could talk about old Canada national anthems, Australians' national song is a folksy little tune about a wandering country bloke who, after stealing a sheep, throws himself in a billy bong to avoid being captured by the police. I love this. In 1988, Christian leader and historian Mal Garvin released a book explaining that the first real white Aussies were not the conflict shipped over here by the British. Those criminals, hand-picked by the best judges in England, looked to England as home. The real history of Australia, he said, is found in the hundreds of orphaned, illegitimate children of those conflicts and their warders. These cornstalks, as they were called, learned from the Aborigines how to love and live in harmony with the land. They cheekily dubbed the English convicts and free settlers as Pommies from POME, Prisoner of Mother England. The first white settlers had been shocked and appalled by the land they found, whereas these native-born thrived on it. The British described Australia as, quote, a fantastic land of monstrosities, unquote, where bark rather than leaves fell off the trees, and where crazed laughter came down from the kookaburras. And there were the wild-eyed birds as tall as a man, called emus, and great leaping rats, known as kangaroos. Somebody told me the other day that when Captain Cook came here, he asked an Aboriginal what was the name of this animal, and he said kangaroo, and that's what Captain Cook named it, and apparently that the kangaroo is the Aboriginal word in that tribe for I don't know. Well, I got it from somebody local. So the soil, according to this article, was rock red, the weather turbulent, and the rain much heavier than the gentle drizzle in England. I don't believe you have rain here. We left home a month ago today. I haven't seen rain yet. The outcome in the global... I'm skipping down a few paragraphs. The outcome on the global scene is a nation keen to stand up for the underdog, demanding justice for the oppressed, but casual and down to earth in achieving it. The she'll be right mate attitude leads at times to a destructive apathy. but also to a flexibility and a nonchalance that allows most Australians to resist the ideological hype of most politicians. I said to Julie this morning, in reading the newspapers now for almost a month, I can't believe it. If you look hard in the paper, you find news, but you have to look beyond the politics and the sports. That's interesting. It's a lot of interest in politics, isn't there, in this country? And this is very interesting for me to observe this kind of thing. A lot of interest in sports, but this man says that you are people who nonchalantly avoid the hype of the politicians. I wish we could learn some of that at home. They're also better than most Westerners, according to this writer, at making friends cross-culturally. And they suffer much less from the cultural imperialism that is so typical of the West. He's writing, I think, and saying some things that are positive about your culture. Australians are practical, highly creative, and wary of all assumed authority. Well, he talks a little bit about politics and life in this country, talks about the Aboriginal people in this country, and then he talks about the Australian church. This was the part that I was especially interested in preparing for this afternoon. Since the time of the first ministers who came to Australia in a dual role as judges of the conflicts and rigid moralists, Australians, as a nation, have been fairly suspicious of the church. Do you buy that? People say that they believe in Jesus, but quote, you wouldn't catch me in church except for a wedding or my own funeral, unquote. Unlike the U.S. church, which occupies an organized place in society, the church in Australia is usually seen as being irrelevant. Somehow, few Christians have learned how to reach into the Australian psyche and imported, prepackaged English and American gospel presentations haven't been especially relevant for Australians. I'm very cautious about the fact that we don't try to bring in some prepackaged counseling approaches and try to make them relevant to the Australians. They need to be adapted. They need to be enculturated. And that's what I think is being done here and what you're doing so well with this. You'll love this sentence. American televangelists are watched by most only for their comedy value. And any message that is not down to earth and practical isn't worth listening to. Somebody said to me yesterday, we were amused by Jimmy Baker. It was Tammy that people were especially interested in around here. And they're willing to forgive Jimmy, but Tammy is maybe a little different. Well, skimming this is an interesting fact. Australia has over 3,000 missionaries, more in proportion to the evangelical population than any other nation. Isn't that interesting? Yet most churches just seem to be surviving. Some Christians believe the church must be either... Some churches believe that the church must either understand and penetrate the culture in the next 10 years or else be forced to witness its own burial. That's a strong statement. But it is a good statement to think about. Is the church going to penetrate the culture in which we live and especially the culture where you serve? I'm skipping down a few more paragraphs. Australians appear cynical about religion, he says, but 87% sheepishly admit that they believe in God. They feel powerless to change things, yet sense that there is something better. In the heart of Australians is a cry for meaning, significance, and empowerment. Gavin and others believe that if the gospel message can be presented in a way that is deeply heard, many will respond. And he goes on in this article to write the fact that there are a lot of people who are open. The harvest really is plentiful. And maybe the laborers are few, but the laborers aren't always sure how to reach the harvest. And here, I think, is the challenge that you face, and a challenge that I think is going to be informing us along the way as you overcome some of the obstacles you face and reach a society which is not really very much open to the gospel. I was interested in picking up a newspaper the other day where somebody said, Easter is coming. And with Easter, of course, most Australians turn their thoughts to chocolate and Easter eggs and 3 days or 4 days of holidays. This is very interesting to me. That there seems to be, the newspapers talking about the fact there is little awareness of the whole issue of Christ coming and dying and the real significance of Easter. When we planned this trip, it was planned that we would stay longer, but somebody said, no, you can't do that because we run into Easter. And Australia and New Zealand shut down at Easter. We don't even have a holiday for Good Friday at home. We don't have Easter Monday either. And yet, it's interesting here that there is such an emphasis here on Easter when maybe there is a de-emphasis on many of the truths of Easter. Julie and I attend a large church, which has become known, I think, in other parts of the world, including, I'm told, here in Australia, where there is a real emphasis in trying to reach people who are unchurched, people who are sometimes turned off by the church, people who are not really interested in being involved in anything that looks churchish. And it's a church that is growing because I think it is meeting the needs of those people. The pastor expressed the opinion several times. And here's a man with this. There's good music. There's a striving for excellence. There is clear biblical preaching. And I want to emphasize that it's not some kind of a wishy-washy type of watered-down message. There's a clear call to commitment. And I think some of these people appreciate that clear call to commitment. Some of you will respond probably like I did when I discovered that they said, if you want to get married in this church, you have to stop living with the person you want to marry at least for a year before we'll allow you to be married in the church. A lot of these people, that's a radical new idea because they've never thought about those kinds of Christian morals that we talk about in the church. But the church seems to have an impact. What the pastor says, many times we go out and we work at evangelism. A lot of people are involved in evangelism, and the church is growing because of new people coming into the church. But then the pastor says, we reach a great impasse because the people don't grow because, as I think I mentioned last night, they bring so much baggage from their past. They've grown up in dysfunctional families. They're adult children of alcoholics. They have got psychological difficulties and tremendous interpersonal difficulties, and these things keep getting in the way of their spiritual growth. So the church has developed support groups and counseling for people who have these background difficulties, who don't know how to function in a healthy family, who don't know how to communicate, who don't know how to really spend time in any kind of private meditation or prayer. These people need to get over some of their own psychological hang-ups before they get going. This morning when I came in, somebody handed me a question. I think it was one of the steering committee, so I don't know who wrote this question, but I think it is a marvelous entree into what we're discussing this afternoon. Person says this, could you please speak about how Christians could care for their brothers and sisters in Christ who have had a mental illness? The stigma placed on those who have struggled with such challenges is very painful. Away from the church, I feel great. I know I am over the problems I faced. I'm excited about my walk with God and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am a person of worth, loved and accepted by my Heavenly Father. But when I'm with people in the church, I feel like a second-class citizen, a leper. People seem to hold me at arm's length as though I'll contaminate them. Some are angry that I needed psychiatric care. Wasn't God enough? Wasn't the power of the Holy Spirit and His gifts enough? I feel particularly judged and condemned by pastors and those in ministry, the so-called counselors, carers, and healers in the church. When I am with them, I feel that I am a failure for having had a breakdown, that I am so far beneath their spiritual status that I am less than human. In short, that I am not worth knowing. And I change from being confident and comfortable with who I am to feeling fragile and very insecure. Is there any hope for a person who has a mental illness to be accepted in his or her church? What a sobering statement. And I wonder if some of the people in our churches are those kinds of people. I wonder if those of us who are sensitive about other people and concerned enough to take time away from our busy, busy schedules and come to a seminar like this, is it possible that some of us kind of look down on those who struggle and fail to realize that if the stress got great enough, probably all of us would collapse. There may be different levels where we would collapse. But we're all vulnerable people, and we're all people under stress. When we had the Congress on Christian Counseling last week, I devoted almost a whole session to talking about counselors who get fragmented, who become burned out, who get going too hard and discover sometimes we take on more than we can handle and wonder why we sort of break down. There's a man that I know has a conference center for pastors, just for pastors. He's a psychiatrist, and he and his wife have this center up in the mountains, and pastors go there with their wives and spend 1, 2, or 3 weeks getting rejuvenated and dealing with the depression and the burnout and the marriage problems and the difficulties with their kids. Pastors have a very, very difficult type of work to do. Those of you who are professional counselors, you know how difficult it is. And that sometimes you've got nobody to talk to. And no person who really understands if you start to wear out. I read a book recently written by a social worker. It's entitled, When Helping You Is Hurting Me. And sometimes that happens. And we don't say no. And I'm the worst example of that. And we don't always take care of ourselves and don't get sufficient rest and wonder why we wear out. And yet I think we have to recognize that we are all individuals. And that's what I was trying to communicate to those brothers and sisters there in Melbourne. And even those of us who are counselors have needs. And I suspect that this is written by somebody who was here last night or this morning. And it's maybe somebody who's here this afternoon. And I suspect that several of us can relate to this, or maybe all of us can relate to this, because we know that when people come into the church and they've struggled with a problem, that sometimes they're rejected. And that's sad. Now, I don't want to be preaching to the people who don't need the preaching at, because you are people who obviously have a concern about these kinds of individuals, these hurting peoples. You do want to be a carer. You do want to be a helper, and that's great. But it's good, I think, for us, before we look at the church per se, to think about the people that we're working with. Who are these people? Who are we trying to care for? The people who might come to us for counseling, the people who might walk into the door of our churches and seek some kind of guidance, the people who might be in this Australian church who've learned to be independent, who've learned to have the she'll be right mate attitude, and then discover sometimes that they're getting depressed and things aren't going as well as they like. The people who really struggle but wonder if they're going to find any kind of help in the church or if they're going to find any help anyplace. Now, we have within this room a lot of knowledge, a lot of resources, a lot of care, a lot of ability to help people. But who are we trying to help? Let's talk about these people for a minute. And I'm talking about the people in our churches who need our counseling, and that includes us at times. Let us never forget that the people that we are working at are, first of all, people. They are human beings. They were created in God's image. They are loved by God. And they are representative of the needy people whom Jesus loved. It is interesting for me to read the history of counseling and talk about how they used to take people at the Bethlehem Hospital in London. And the people who lived in that part of London couldn't say the Bethlehem Hospital, and so they shortened it to the word Bedlam. And the people who were in Bedlam were people who were brought out on Sunday afternoon and put in cages, and you could go to the zoo on the afternoon for a shilling and look at the animals, or you could go to Bedlam on a Sunday afternoon and look at those freaks in the hospital. Now, of course, we're a long way from that. But I wonder if sometimes we forget people are people. And we forget some of those Aboriginal people who think so differently than we do. Julia and I heard a lecture about this the other night. It was very interesting for us about the kinds of people, the Aboriginal thinking, the tribal customs, and that kind of thing. Do we forget people who are in the downtown district? We were instructed when we came, be careful, don't talk about going downtown, because that means something different in Brisbane than what it means in America. Where we are, downtown means the center of the city, but in some places in Australia, at least, it means the red light district, so don't say you are going downtown. But what about some of those people downtown? They're people. And what about these people who struggle? People who are in psychiatric hospitals. People who are poor. People who are in that section of Brisbane that we drove around yesterday with those beautiful houses, and somebody said, this is where the up and outers live. We forget, don't we, that those are people. Well, I don't have to belabor the point, but let's not forget that. Let's not forget that these are unique. We sometimes put labels on them. We give them labels in terms of the temperaments. We may give them labels in terms of psychiatric diagnoses, but they are unique people. With unique needs and unique fears and unique struggles and unique concerns and unique hopes for the future. This is all very obvious, but we forget it, don't we? That we are dealing with unique individuals, and even though they may come from a similar group, they're still unique people. Also, they are hurting people. First, they are people. Secondly, they are unique. Thirdly, they are hurting. Sometimes they deny that they're hurting. They don't mention it. Sometimes they try to hide it, and they're very good at it, especially if you're trying to hide something like depression. I read someplace that depression is not only the most common psychological difficulty, but it is the one that is hidden best, especially by men. And we become depressed, and we go through life being generally depressed, or hitting periods of time when we're depressed, but we smile on the outside, and nobody would suspect it. Well, but nevertheless, we hurt on the inside. And there's a lot of people who are frustrated by the stresses that they can't handle. They're frustrated because their work is not going as well as they would like. They are afraid. They are lonely. They are self-condemning. They are guilty. Sometimes they're anxious about their marriages and about their kids. Sometimes they are basically angry. And often they begin to think, I look around me and here is everybody else in the church that seems to be getting along so well. All of my professional colleagues seem to be coping so well. And look at me. Look at the struggles I'm having. This came up this morning after the session. We get into a discussion very briefly about kids. Julie and I have two daughters. We have marvelous rapport with our kids, and we're really grateful for that. And I think all four of us have worked on that. But have we had some problems with our kids? We sure have. Have we had some painful experiences with our kids? Yes, we have. And not long ago, Julie was sharing, I think I can share this publicly, with Marie Little. Some of you may recognize the name Paul Little. He wrote a number of books about evangelism, a marvelous man. He and I were on the same faculty before he was killed tragically in a car accident several years ago. And Marie Little goes to the same church that we do. And she and Julie were having a little chat one night after church not long ago. And Marie said, you know, it's interesting you look around and you think that other people's kids are, and these are her words, squeaky clean, you know. Everybody else has perfect kids. Do you exchange Christmas letters in this country? No. And you get Christmas cards with letters in. I love reading those letters because people talk about their kids and they talk about our oldest daughter's got all these awards. Our second son, he's at the top of his football league. I've never heard anybody say we're having problems with one of our kids. They're always all, and you say, man, everybody else's kids are doing very well. What about mine? And you know, kids, it takes a while for them, doesn't it, to get through difficult periods of time. And we've watched our kids go into some difficult periods and come out of some difficult periods. And I'm convinced, and Julie is convinced, these kids, they're going to be all right. But we have there's still a few hurdles to overcome, and they know it, and we know it, and we're all working on it. But what about that if we don't mention that kind of thing? What if we don't admit that we're vulnerable? We think everybody else is getting along so well. Incidentally, if you're having some struggles with your kids, let me suggest that you read the first three verses of Isaiah. You can probably remember that. You don't have to read it now because people will see you turning to it. But this is the place where the Lord says, the Lord says, children I have brought up, and they have rebelled against me. Isn't that interesting? God himself, the perfect parent, raises up his kids and they didn't quite go in the direction that he kind of hoped they would go. And I think we need to recognize then that the people that we minister to, a lot of them are struggling, a lot are hurting, a lot of them smile on the outside but have a lot of pain on the inside. And a lot of them have difficulties. Some of them are confused about their thinking. Some have misperceptions. Some people have emotional strains. And some people have behavioral problems. And some are withdrawn. And some are guilty. And some are frustrated. And it's not easy to deal with these people. And I might point out that many of them are trying to cope. And they're having difficulty sometimes. So they're people. They're unique. They're hurting often. They're trying to cope often. And we forget that. And many of those people also are physically ill, and we forget about that. And sometimes they have psychological stress and spiritual struggles, but there's physical things that contribute to that too. And if anybody comes along and says, you're depressed, well, if you are a Christian, you shouldn't get depressed. Wasn't God enough? Wasn't the power of the Holy Spirit and His gifts, weren't they enough? What if you have a physiologically based depression, as an example? Here's a place where you need to get good medical treatment. Well, most of us accept that. Most of us agree to that. But sometimes attitudes come out that are not good. Now, all of this leads me then to the question of how do we bring Christian counseling into the church in a way that is relevant? Now, I'd like to draw a picture on the board that I think we'll summarize this, and probably we'll focus most of our attention during our session this afternoon on this picture. It will consist of a circle. This is a circle. Okay. Sometimes circles don't always come out looking circular, but that's a circle, all right? Now, let's think of it for a few minutes as if it is a wheel. And everybody knows that a wheel has some kind of an axis in the middle around which the wheel revolves, right? When I was a young fellow one time, I had a car. It was an old beat-up car. I paid $75 for it. And even when I was young, you can gather this $75 car left something to be desired. We lived in a place that had hills, and I used to park my car on a slope. And that way I could get it rolling, and once it could get rolling, I could get it started because it wouldn't always start. And I'd go almost down to the hill. By the time I was getting down to the hill, it was moving along fine. I'd drive around to where I was going and then go part way back up the hill and park it on the slope again just to be sure that it was going to go. I obviously am not very mechanical and didn't quite know how to deal with this trauma of a car that was hurting and physically ill and needing help and all that sort of stuff. Now, this car, one day I was on a date, and we were downtown, and all of a sudden I heard the back of the car go thump. Now, some of you will not understand this. In the north, the far north, where you have ice all winter, the ground freezes, the pavement expands, and then it goes down again, and so sometimes you get what we call potholes in the road. As you drive along, you hit a pothole, it can do a great deal of damage to the car. But I was living in a place like Brisbane where they didn't get snow in the winter, and they didn't have potholes. Oh, you do have potholes in Brisbane. I know, and you put that bread in the potholes, and that's where you heat it to cook it. Yes, I know about that. Okay. Well, anyhow, this night I heard this thump, and I looked into my rearview mirror, and there was my wheel. It had come off, and it was going down the middle of the street, wobbling all over the place. Incidentally, that was the last time I dated that girl. She found somebody with a better car, and I hooked up with Julie, and she's been with me ever since, and that's good. She's very good at changing tires. All right. A wheel that is not connected to an axle wobbles, right? So if we're going, this I'm going to use to represent what I call Christian counseling, especially as it relates to the church. But it has got to have a central core here. And as this central core, I would like to suggest that it needs to be a biblical theological core around which all of our Christian counseling activities need to circulate. Now, some of you are theological students. I know that. And you focus your attention on that biblical theological core. Let me suggest to you that that is very important. The biblical core suggests that we understand the New Testament, that we understand the teachings of the Old Testament, that we know about systematic theology, that we know about things like hermeneutics, that I think I mentioned last night, how we interpret the Scripture, that we know things like ethics and Christian ethics and what that teaches us, that we know some principles of apologetics, how we can defend the faith against its attackers. Those kinds of things, I think, are crucial issues, and some others, for counseling students to know. Now, I went to seminary for 1 year, so I don't have a theological degree. But I try to continue to read in this area, because I think that has to be the core around which our whole Christian counseling operates. And it's an important core and a significant core. But let me suggest that there is a second core, another rim, perhaps. Now, I would like to suggest that this is sort of a psychological, sociological type of rim. Here is a rim, looks at psychological, social type of behavior. Here is a rim that focuses on an understanding of how people tick. I suggest that if you're going to be involved in Christian counseling in the local church, it's not only important that you know the biblical, theological basis of what you believe, but it's important and very helpful for you to understand some input from psychology, learning, perception, motivation. What causes pathology? Why do people get depressed and anxious and angry, pathologically angry? What do we know about principles of counseling? What do we know about theories of counseling? What do we know about social behavior and how groups influence individuals? All of those are crucial issues. And I suggest that these are things that we can learn. Now, some of you are graduate students in psychology and sociology. Your training at the secular university probably is giving you a lot of emphasis in the second rim. And that can be very helpful, too. If you are a theologian focusing on the first rim, try and get some understanding of the second rim. If you are a psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, sociologist, anthropologist, somebody who's working in the outside rim, try to make sure that you are increasing your understanding of that inner core. Because I think both of them can help us to understand the people that we're trying to deal with. Now, with this circle and this core, let me put some spokes in our wheel. I'm going to divide this into six parts. And then I'd like to focus our attention on these six spaces, because I suggest to you that these six spaces are where we can have our greatest impact as Christian counselors, and where we can be having an impact tying Christian counseling and having it relevant to the local church. Now, the first of these segments, I'm going to call the... Let's use the term people helpers instead of counselors. Let's say here is a place where we have professional, P-R-O-F, people helpers. There are some who are here. These are people who have the training, usually at some kind of an advanced level. Maybe at the bachelor's level, perhaps at the master's level. I've talked to several MA students who are here at this conference. Perhaps at the doctoral level. Here are people who probably, for the most part, are working full-time as Christian counselors. They are people who have that professional type of expertise and training, and they've taken the examinations. They've got the number of supervision hours that they need. Somebody raised a question about supervision, a good one. We'll come back to that later. But they've taken the number of hours that they need. They have been licensed by the appropriate agency for licensing people. And they are people who have been able to get the best training they can within their professions. Do we need those kinds of people in the church? We certainly do. Because those kinds of people in the church, if they're committed followers of Jesus Christ, especially if they're people who know some biblical theological input as well as this psychological social input, they can have an influence in every other part of this circle. They are the people who can help to enlighten people in the church so they don't develop attitudes that came out in this question. These professional people very often can lead seminars in the church. They can often lead workshops in the church. They can encourage the pastor of the church and the Christian leaders in the church. These professional people can often teach courses in our Bible colleges. And of course, this is what happens right here, because I've met several of those people since I've been here. These are people who can be doing a great deal to stimulate Christian counseling in and through the church. Most of you probably don't fit that category. But those people are crucial people. I would hope that out of this conference, we would have a few people who'd walk out of this room and say, I think that I've begun to sense that maybe that's where I fit. Maybe I should get more training and move into this area and take some leadership in this area. You are the kinds of people who are going to be taking the leadership in Christian counseling in Australia in this coming decade, in the next century, and quite likely have a significant leadership role to play in Christian counseling as it develops worldwide in the next 15, 20 years. I have a friend back home who believes that the Christian counseling movement is just about ready to explode. He says that he doesn't think it's exploded yet. He thinks it's just about ready to take off, because somehow people are beginning to recognize the great needs we have. The Christian counselors don't all have two heads and four legs. That many are committed followers of Jesus Christ, that much can be learned from these people, that it can have a relevance in evangelism and discipleship, in working with our kids, in working with pastors, in reaching out to the society around us that doesn't understand anything about Easter except Easter eggs. And we can have that kind of influence, and we're going to have to get more and more people into this field. If you're moving in that direction, I applaud you. Keep moving in that direction. I'd like to encourage you. And if that's all I accomplish coming to Australia and coming to Queensland, that'll be worth it if we get some people moving in that direction. Now, there are others of you, however, who probably identify more with this second group. These are the pastoral people helpers. Interesting to me that many professionals in group number one sort of look down on the pastors, and they say, well, after all, if you can't be a professional counselor, you can always be a pastor. I am convinced not having had the personal experience, but I'm convinced that being a pastor is one of the toughest jobs anybody has. Julie says I would last maybe a half a day as a pastor. I'm not sure I'd survive that long. It would be a very difficult task. Pastors are the people who have to deal with these difficult problems that come along, who have to deal with the crises in people's lives, who have a responsibility for preaching messages every week, who get criticized if the messages aren't relevant and to the point, who try to deal with the youth in the church and the elderly people in the church, and in some churches who also serve very effectively as janitors, operators of the coffee machine, and secretaries. And it's not easy to do all of those things and to do the job effectively. Pastors at one time had a lot of prestige in the society, but they don't anymore. At least not in the society where I live, and based on this article with which I started this afternoon, probably not in the society where you live. And a lot of people come along and say, you're a pastor? Why don't you get a real job? You just work on Sundays. That must be nice. You know the struggles you have, and some of you are pastors' wives, and you know the difficulties of this. I went 22 years ago to teach in a theological seminary. Can I be honest in telling you that I had some real mixed feelings about it? Because I was in this first group. I have a PhD in clinical psychology. I'm going to a theological seminary? And some of my colleagues looked at me and wondered, Gary, what in the world are you doing that for? But then I began to recognize something. There has been research. Now, I haven't found parallel research in Australia. I looked a little bit, but not a lot. And maybe there isn't research like this in Australia. But they asked people, if you had a problem, where would you go? And they discover that more people, at least in the United States, more people will go to a pastor than to any other professional group. The most recent figures, which I covered up here, from a survey done in 1976, which is a long way back, people said, if you had a problem, where would you seek help? 39% said I'd go to a minister, a priest, or a rabbi, somebody in the clergy. 21% said, no, 29%, 39% said they go to clergy. 29% said I'd go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. 21% said I'd go to an MD. I'd go to my general local practitioner, and the rest would go to different groups of people in the community. But see, 40% said I'd find a minister. Well, you know why they go to ministers. Several reasons. Ministers are available. Ministers are less threatening. Ministers are easy to find, and ministers are free. Yes, okay. Now, of course, I knew that would wake some of you up, yes. Of course, Freud came along and said, that which is free isn't worth much. And that kind of attitude sort of tacks onto us, doesn't it? And so sometimes we think, well, they come to us because we're free, and some people latch onto us, don't they? And the professional can say, well, sorry, it's going to be $150 after this hour. And that does have a way of weeding out people. Try that with a deacon who keeps coming to you and see how far you get. Now, what can the pastor do in all of this? Well, the pastor can grow in understanding. I applaud those of you who are here because you don't have to be here. And many of you probably are finding it is difficult to be here. And you know you've got a sermon coming up Sunday morning, and you probably haven't found anything yet to go into the sermon. Okay, later on I'll try to give you a couple of biblical passages with some three-point outlines so you're ready. But look around to make sure that none of your parishioners are here, or they know you got it. However, I have learned that if you use different examples, they won't pick up the outline. It's the examples they remember, okay? All right. Pastor can grow, but you're here. Pastor can grow in understanding, and this is what you are trying to do. And I think if you can continue to understand and grow and learn. Yesterday at lunch, we had some interesting discussions about how we could stimulate continued understanding and continual education for people here in Queensland and throughout Australia, and especially for pastors. And if something like that comes out of this conference, won't that be an exciting development? Something we weren't expecting. The pastor can grow in understanding. The pastor can detect problems because the pastor sees them before any professional does. You have the family there every week. You are able to do something that none of the rest of us can do. You can make house calls. Although, incidentally, professional counseling at home is starting to put more and more emphasis on making house calls. Because we know that if you go into a home, you can see a dynamic that is entirely different than if they come into your office. And sometimes you can see the whole family together, and that gives you a lot of information you don't get otherwise. But pastors can spot problems in the early stages and often make interventions in the early stages, and that's a significant role. And what I'm saying about pastors also applies to pastors' spouses and other members who are in leadership capacity in the church. Pastors can counsel. The pastor is often the front line of treatment when problems come along. No professional has any right to put down a pastor because the pastors are more on the front lines than any of us. This includes the youth pastors. And they're out there spotting those problems and dealing with those problems long before they would ever get to any of us who are in the professions. But the pastor can also make referrals. The pastor can know who in the community can take referrals, who are the competent people in the community, who are the people who will accept a referral. And if you're a pastor, this is something to find out about your community. Who is there? If you don't know, maybe you should ask some other pastors who have been there longer. Maybe you can pool some of your resources. Who are the people to whom you can make a referral? And it may not be a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Maybe somebody who works with people with financial problems. Maybe the Society for the Blind can deal with some family that's got a family member that is losing sight, or it's got a child that is blind. Many times you can see people in the community that are making an impact and can give you some input that are not necessarily professional counselors. Maybe you need to refer somebody to a local MD. Maybe you need to get somebody to a good lawyer who can help them make some legal decisions that you don't know anything about. The pastor, furthermore, can educate professionals. The movement doesn't all come from here to here. Some of the movement goes from the pastor to the professionals. Now, I will be the first to admit that professionals aren't always interested in being educated by pastors. But I think there's a little bit of a change. And when there is good rapport between pastors and professionals, the professionals are willing to learn too. As long as and they kind of get threatened too. Nothing more threatening to a professional therapist than a minister. And if you can go in a non-threatening way, often you can get a hearing and you can educate those people. The pastor can cooperate in treatment. This will depend a little bit on the professional counselor, whether or not the professional will go along with this. But often a team approach will come about where the person's pastor and the professional can work together. Perhaps you have not had that experience. As a professional in the community, if you could do some things together, you could probably learn from one another, and I think it could be helpful for the person who is getting the treatment. The pastor can educate parishioners. Who is going to deal with this kind of attitude in the church? Probably the pastor more than anybody else. Not necessarily getting up and reading something like this, but encouraging people in the church. How do we respond to people in the church who have been in a mental hospital? But how do we respond to people in the church who've been in jail? Same issue. If you've been in jail, you come back to church and the church doesn't want you. Or, think about divorce. I know there are some people here who've been divorced. How did the church receive you after you were divorced? Sometimes the church looks at divorce like the unpardonable sin. Yes, people who have divorced have had difficulties. Yes, they've made some mistakes. Yes, things haven't gone well. Yes, God hates divorce. But God also doesn't say that you treat divorced people like they sort of have the plague. And I think we need to stand clearly by the biblical principles, but show compassion. And sometimes you, as a church leader, need to take the leadership in showing that kind of compassion. And as we'll say in a minute or two, I think the pastor can furthermore become a public people helper. Sometimes what you say from the pulpit can make a significant impact. Now, I am not suggesting that you water down the Bible and give little talks about how to be happy, though a person. That kind of thing. I'm suggesting that you give messages that are relevant, that have real bearing on where people are, on where they're hurting. Many, many years ago, 100 years ago, there was an older pastor in England named Joseph Parker, I think his name was, was talking to a group of young ministerial students, and he said to these ministerial students, "Preach to the needs of the people in the pew, and you will never lack a congregation." Isn't that interesting? Then he went on to say, "There is likely to be a broken heart in every pew." That's an interesting thing to think about. sometimes people turn off the church because the church doesn't talk about their needs. And it is boring and it is irrelevant. I don't know about you, but I've gotten to the point in life where I don't like to listen to boring speakers. I don't like to listen to boring sermons. And I think most people don't like it either. Sometimes I'll go to church out of habit, and maybe some of you do too, but I think you can make a significant impact if you can meet the needs of people. They're going to come and the pastor can do that. And then the pastor can encourage lay counseling. The pastor, like Jethro and Moses in the Old Testament, the pastor can say, don't put it all on me. We need to be a body of caring individuals who are mutually concerned, who are compassionate, who are caring, who are building up one another. And I suggest that this is not going to work unless the pastor is willing to model some of that. And the pastor is willing to be a little bit vulnerable. And maybe even to mention sometimes that he or she doesn't have it all together. Because I hardly know anybody who's got it all together. In fact, I can't think of anybody right now that I know who's got it all together. We are all people who are growing, we're maturing, we're making some advances, but nobody's got a perfect marriage. Julie and I almost do because I'm so easy to live with. But not everybody does. We all struggle, don't we? And I think if we can, I'm not suggesting you get up in the pulpit on Sunday morning and say, I went to a seminar on Christian counseling. Let me tell you about my problems for the next half hour. I'm sure you'll find it interesting. That's not what I'm suggesting. But sometimes if you express a vulnerability and let people know that we're all growing, I think this helps to build that kind of rapport and that kind of caring in the body of Christ. I think the church can be and should be a caring community. And when it's a caring community, I think it's a growing community. It's a biblically alert community. And it's a community that can be reaching out into the society around us. It's an evangelizing community. Well, but the pastor has a lot of the challenge here. Now, I'm not trying to send some of you people any kind of a guilt trip because you're not doing all of this. What I'm suggesting is that as you go away from here, try to think of some creative ways that you can stimulate counseling and people helping in your church. Well, I mentioned a minute ago about lay people. Let's call them peers.
See, I know that there are some pastors here. Pastors, as you know,
like three-point sermons with proper alliteration, right? Alliteration means everything starts with the same letter. So you've got professional counseling, pastoral counseling, and peer people helping. Are you impressed? Thank you.
Okay. Nobody has the courage to say no.
All right. Now, when we're talking about peers, that's what's down in this bottom one, if you can't see here. We're talking about people helping other people. Now, this is the issue of lay counseling. Lay counseling has become a major topic that has emerged within the past, 10 years within the church. It began apart from the church. Some of the earliest work was done when they taught students how to help other students. When they moved into prisons and were helping prisoners counsel other prisoners, there's a good rapport. They speak the same terminology. They're the same socioeconomic class, and neither of them is going anyplace. They're both available. And they decided that they would start to work them on teaching prisoners to help other prisoners. And they discovered that some of those prisoners could work very well. And suddenly this has caught on. Before I wrote the People Helper book, I went to a seminar one time. And there was a man giving us doing a workshop on peer counseling. It's a good workshop. I was enjoying it. He was talking about prisons. He was talking about business. He was talking about schools. He was talking about communities. He was talking about parents helping other parents and married couples helping other married couples. And I put my hand up after about a day and a half and I said, what about people in the church helping one another? And he got this funny look on his face and he said, that is a very creative idea. Apparently he had never thought about the fact that we ought to be doing this in the church and that we have been since way back. But we can be doing it better. And here's a place where lay counseling can have an impact. I hate to keep mentioning books, although there's a couple of questions that come up about this. There's a new book by a man named Sin Yang Tan. Forget the Sin Yang, remember the Tan. And it's a book called Lay Counseling. It's a brand new book published by Zondervan Press. It's only been out about 2 months. I know the book quite well because I wrote the foreword to it. Sun Yang Tan is a resident. He came from Singapore. He's now in at Fuller Theological Seminary. And he's written this book on lay counseling. And he talks a lot about what lay counseling is. It's become a big movement at home. Now, there's some things we have to think about in lay counseling. Things like, how do you select your lay counselors? Have you noticed that if you announce you're going to have a lay counseling program, you get all kinds of people coming, including people who shouldn't be there? One of the ways you can avoid this is to not call it counseling, because people love to think they're counselors. Call it people helping or caring, and that weeds out some people. But you may also find that if you announce this, that some people are going to come who shouldn't be there. Other people are not going to come who should be there, because they're people who are having a marvelous impact in caring for one another, but it never occurred to them that they might be a lay people helper. And you have to kind of encourage those people to come, but it's hard to make those selections. And then how do you train them? Well, there are all kinds of training programs that have been developed and are being developed. I haven't encountered any formally presented in Australia, but some of the people who are sponsoring this conference certainly have a training program which is designed to equip people helpers, lay people helpers. And that kind of thing needs to be stimulated and developed. Teaching them not only counseling skills and listening skills, but teaching them some of this biblical and theological stuff at the center of the circle. Teaching them some of this psychological, sociological stuff at the other parts of the circle. Teaching them some skills that will enable them to be better people helpers. Teaching them some skills to make referrals so it doesn't become a case of a little knowledge being a dangerous thing. You can work. Sometimes you may find kids in the high school department that can help one another. And that can serve a useful purpose. Now, these people need to be supervised. Because if you don't supervise them, sometimes they get in over their heads, they forget to make referrals, and they get so caught up with the problems of the people they're trying to counsel that they develop what has been called the Messiah complex. Have you ever experienced that? Not in the lay counselors, but in yourself. You are going to help to solve the problems of the world. And you get so involved with another person, and you are sincerely, genuinely concerned about other people. And next thing you know, your people helping is taking up all of your time. Many years ago, I did a workshop on lay counseling for lay counselors. I can still remember where it was. It was in southern Florida. And after the meeting, a lady came up to me and she said, will you tell me how I can get to my husband? He operates a Christian bookstore. And he sells Christian books, including books on counseling, including, quite frankly, Gary, some of yours. And she said, people come into the bookstore and they're so needy and they got so many problems that night after night somebody says, well, look, the bookstore is closing. Why don't we go and have a cup of coffee and let me see if I can help you? And she said, my husband goes in early in the morning, works all day in the bookstore, and then he works with these people at night and he spends time talking to them on the phone. He said, is there any way that you could get the message to him that I'm here too? I don't know if I should tell you about the time Julie, this was many years ago, called my secretary at a place I was working and asked for an appointment with me. That may strike a little too close to home. Because sometimes, our motives are good, and we get so involved in people helping. Well, sometimes our lay people can do that, and we need to kind of help them to disengage and to recognize that sometimes you need to pull back and not be swamped by people, because some of the people we're trying to help have a marvelous way of manipulating our behavior or of manipulating us, and we're not even aware of it. Okay? We need to be training those people. We can come back to that again later if you wish. I think we need to be training lay people in the church. I think that is a crucial area. Now, these are all people, the professionals, the pastors, and the peers, or the lay people. I suspect most of us fall into one or more of those categories. On the other side of this thing, I want to put three different sort of approaches, if you wish. Not so much people. For example, let's change color here. I think we need to be concerned about preventive people helping. See, up to this point, we've been talking about Christian counseling and Christian people helping, and we are assuming the person already has the problem, it's already well developed, and they're going for help. And of course we need to give that kind of a help. But many years ago, the medical profession learned that a better way to treat malaria is to give a person an inoculation before they go into a malaria-infested area, so therefore they don't get that problem. Maybe we can do some things that are preventive. And so we give our kids vaccinations. When you come off the plane, coming into almost any country, any international country that I've visited in the last two or three years, I've got some kind of a form in my hand. It happened in Sydney a month ago. Give me this form about AIDS in Australia and how to keep from contracting AIDS and keep from spreading AIDS. They're trying to prevent this AIDS epidemic. The newspaper this morning, the Brisbane newspaper, had an article in which it said that AIDS may be around for 200 more years. Interesting article. Well, we're trying then to prevent that disease from spreading. Now, can we do this as Christian counselors? I think we can. But let me suggest to you that there is no institution in all of society that can do this better than the church. Because churches are spread throughout the society. Churches hit people at all socioeconomic levels. Churches reach people at all different age groups. Churches reach whole families. Churches are there when a crisis comes along. Churches are there when there's a significant change point come along, and that's when people are more likely to have problems. Churches build a trust relationship along the way, and we can be doing the prevention. The only problem is we don't know how to do it. Now, we do some of it with premarital counseling. So the only problem is, I think we do premarital counseling too late. We bring people in 2 weeks before the wedding to talk about whether or not they should marry this person. That's not going to work. They've already bought the flowers. They've already got the photographer. They've already bought the cake. They've rented the hall. You can't back out then just because you're incompatible and probably not going to get along. What will the neighbors think? I suggest we need to be doing some of our premarital preventive counseling sooner. Like when kids are in high school. Like when they're younger. Now, you don't call it premarital counseling, but teach them some things about marriage. Let them see what marriages are like. Give them a perspective on what marriages should be like, a Christian marriage should be like. Talk to the college-age people about this. Work on helping them to understand. That's premarital counseling. I probably have alluded to the fact already that Julie and I work every Sunday with a young group of married couples at the church where we attend. And we talk about getting along with each other. What's it like to build a marriage during those first two or three or four years, because that's where most of them are? How does marriage survive the coming of children? I read some research the other day about the fact that the coming of children, especially the first child, can put more pressure on a marriage. Well, the second child puts a different kind of pressure on a marriage. Did any of you experience that? Marriage moving along smoothly, and then along comes the child that you wanted, and that child does very inconvenient things, like crying in the middle of the night, or like getting sick at inopportune times, or growing older and taking away your privacy, or taking away your money, or taking away your time. Or taking away your work on advancing your career. See, how do we prevent that from disrupting us? Those are things that I think we can do. Marriage enrichment programs. Those can be very, very helpful. How do we prepare people for retirement? Those can be very good training programs. Our youth groups can be marvelous preventive people helping activities and opportunities. So don't put down the person who's the youth leader. Most of us don't put down the youth leader. We admire and respect the youth leader and thank the Lord that somebody else is doing it, not us. Because it's hard to keep up with those people. After you get to be about 18, you can't keep up anymore with a 15-year-old. But nevertheless, that's prevention. Can we think of some creative ways to be doing prevention in and through the church? I think if we can, then we're not going to need some of this counseling we've been talking about in the last two sessions. Now, I've already alluded to public people helping. Have you ever thought what a man like James Dobson accomplishes? Being on, 600 radio stations every day? Listened to and is widely respected by people who never darken the door of a church? Think about that a little bit. Or think about people who can write articles and reach people who would never talk to them. A lot of people will never come to a counselor, but they might read an article, especially if it's well-written, concise, and easy to read. Or how about reaching people when you speak to a group of kids after a youth rally sometime, or after a concert, or maybe when you preach a sermon on Sunday morning, or teach a class, or maybe you work in a university or a Bible college someplace, and you've never quite thought about the fact that you can often be a very good public people helper as you take that leadership position. You can be a people helper by your speaking, and also by your modeling. A new book has recently come out on the importance of modeling, and sometimes we forget about that. And I mentioned this morning. But public people helping can have a great impact because many times people are not going to go to a counselor. And we can talk about Christian counseling all we want, but there are some Australian males, just like there are some American males and some Canadian males, who are not going to be caught dead or alive in the office of a counselor. So we may have to get them in some other way. We got into a debate about this one place the other day. Somebody said, how are we going to reach the Australian male? There's no way to reach the Australian male. I said, well, that's a creative question you have to deal with, but I notice there's a lot of interest in sports. What about bringing a sports figure in sometime to talk? I wonder what kind of an influence Ron Grant will have in some parts of Australia. I mean, we saw him yesterday in the last stage of his run. I mean, he didn't come by to let us see him. We just happened to be there. And the police were in front riding on motorcycles. I did not know this until I read the paper this morning, but he was running, accompanied on one side by the premier of the state and by the Anglican Archbishop on the other side. Hopefully those people didn't have to go too far, but they were running with him on the last leg of the journey. And here they were going up a hill, humping up a hill at the end of that kind of an impact. Well, okay. You may have mixed feelings about this, but sometimes a sports figure who is a Christian can have a wonderful effect on reaching men and can deal with the issues of loneliness and frustration and misplaced values in terms of our careers and can do it publicly. And I don't make that in any kind of a second-class type of counseling. I think that's a crucial type of work that the church can do, and a lot of people in our society can't do it. You may have to get out of a church building to do it. You may have to go to a hotel or a civic center someplace because people don't want to come into the church building. Think of creative ways to do that. Now, I have one last piece of my pie here. And you know that I'm going to start with the letter P because all of the rest of the things start with the letter P. And I do stretch this a little bit. But I think there's a place for what I'm going to call psychological. P-S-Y-C-H is psychological. Apologetics. Remember to talk about apologetics. People helping. Now, apologetics, you remember, is a psychological apologetic people helping. Apologetics, you remember, is that branch of theology that defends the church and defends Christianity against its critics. Where are the critics coming now that are attacking the church? Please don't misunderstand what I say here, but I'm not sure that the evolutionists are attacking us much. I applaud people who are working in this field, but I think if you went on the university of campuses, there's probably not much discussion of evolution and creation. I think some of the issues that we were concerned about, that apologists were concerned about in the past, are not really the hot issues today. But let me suggest to you that many of the hot issues today are psychologically based issues. A couple of questions have come in about New Age movement ideas. University campuses are very much interested in Eastern mysticism that undermines what we believe, in UFOs, and people read their horoscopes with great interest. And cultic activities are having an impact, and people in the universities are interested in this kind of thing. And you have a lot of New Age influences that are permeating our culture and are undermining much of what we're thinking. And a lot of those New Age influences are often influences in helping people to get along better with their marriages, helping them channel better, helping them to get in touch with something. There's a lady on television yesterday morning, I just happened to pass through us. I was skimming the top. I was looking for the news, actually, but when I was looking at the wrong time, so I got this lady. I just watched it for probably 3 or 4 minutes, and she was talking about how that her channeling and her time with this guru somehow had just made a world of difference, and now she was finally happy. And so along comes a replacement for Christianity. That's where a lot of people are today. And a lot of those things are psychologically based, and I think we need to deal with those. How do we deal with people who come along and say, your miracles that you Christians believe in, we can explain those away. Your healings that people believe in, we can explain those away. Those of you who are concerned about worship, we can all account for that. Those of you who are talking about glossolalia, we're talking the Bible about speaking in tongues, we sure can explain all that stuff away. And almost anything we believe, people come along, often psychologists and psychiatrists, and explain it away. How do we deal with those things? A couple of questions came in this morning. What do you do when Freud comes along and says everybody's neurotic who's a Christian? And people go to the university and they read Freud, even though he wrote that many years ago, and they say, Freud said everybody's a neurotic. Freud said it must be right. And then you begin to recognize that Freud had a biased sample. Let me give you an example of this. Suppose I came to Queensland and I was doing research. And I wanted to do surveys of people who lived in Queensland. And I thought, now where can I get a survey of 300 people that I can interview on some topic? Well, I go around and everybody's busy in the church and everybody's busy in government and people who are working in the industries, they're all busy. Where is there a place where I can find 300 people that are all in the same place and not going anyplace? I know. I'll go to the state mental institution and I'll interview all those people and they're all there. And I'll get information from them. Now, what kind of a sample would I have? I would have a biased sample, wouldn't I? And I could go back home and I could say, you know, all of the people in Queensland are emotionally disturbed. Well, it's not a very good conclusion because they have a biased sample. That's exactly what Freud did. He looked at all of these people coming to him for help. And basically he said, every Christian I've talked to has got psychological problems. Because he never saw a healthy one in his whole life. Now, that needs to be pointed out before you buy into Freud's theory so quickly. We need to answer those things. Now, let me draw a couple little diagrams on here and then we'll take our questions. I think we can go around this circle in several different ways. We've talked about counseling. Let's talk about marriage. Some of you are interested in marriage counseling. We can be doing professionals involved in this. We can have pastors involved in marriage counseling. We can have married couples helping other married couples. We can be doing premarital counseling and marriage enrichment. That's prevention. We can be talking about marriage and the family from our pulpits and from our seminars, and that's helping people in a public way. We can be dealing with those people who come along and challenge the permanence of marriage, and we can be dealing with those arguments. What about young people? We can be doing professional counseling with adolescents, teenagers who are depressed. A very high rate of suicide among kids in Australia. We can be doing pastoral counseling and having youth workers deal with those kids. We can have kids helping other kids, and to a large extent that is done and that helps. We can be preventing kids from having problems, and if our programs are right, many times that will happen. I came up with some research the other day that I shared someplace else where they were talking about how you can prepare your kids for adulthood. They did a survey of 46,000 kids between the ages of 13 and 18. This was an American study. It was just published about 2 months ago, and they were talking about how you can prevent kids from having problems. Interesting. They said when kids have good relationships with their families, when the families put some limits on them, when the families take an interest in their schoolwork, when the kids are involved in music and sports, all those things prevent kids from having problems. Did I tell you about the Midnight Basketball League where we live? They discovered in the inner city of Chicago that there was a high crime rate, especially among teenagers, especially after midnight. And some enterprising person said, why don't we do something with those kids after midnight? Why don't we start a basketball league and all the games will be between 1 and 3 in the morning? We got all the gymnasiums, they're not being used. So they went to the businesses in the community, some of which have been vandalized by these kids, and they said, would you buy them it's not a jumper, Julie, what do you call it? Singlet, yeah, thank you. Would you buy them singlets with the name of your team on? Would you sponsor a team? And they got all these teams of inner city kids, and they have a basketball league. And instead of getting in trouble on the streets, they go to play basketball. And they get trophies, and they have a basketball banquet to see who the winner is, presumably at 2:30 in the morning. And sometimes other kids come along to cheer. It's a very enthusiastic league, which is now being developed in other parts of the country where they have inner-city problems with kids after midnight. And guess what has happened to the crime rate? It's gone down. Some creative individual has begun to think we can be doing something to prevent problems with kids. Some of you are involved in youth rallies. That's public people helping. Some of you know the struggles kids face when they go to the, when they go off to there's classes, when they go to the universities. What do they encounter? What undercuts their Christian faith? Some of the psychological arguments. What about the pressures they encounter in terms of sex and alcohol, that kind of thing? That's giving them some reasons for believing and standing the way they do. Now, we can go around. Some of you are interested in missions. Let's go around once again. Professionals can be involved in missions. I believe that pastors can often be involved in missions. And one of the exciting things that's taking place in parts of the world that are developing countries, the third world nations, we're seeing professionals just getting an insight into what professional counseling is. I go to countries sometimes and people say to me, we've only got one Christian psychiatrist in the whole country that we know about. And there are countries like that. But there are often pastors who are doing the work, and they like Yugoslavia, they are people who are learning and they're making a significant contribution. Lay people can be making an impact, and we can be training the lay people in evangelism. We can be training them in Bible study, and we can be training them in caring, compassionate skills. That's missions. And we can be trained in doing some prevention. We can prevent missionaries from having problems, and many of them do when they get into the stresses they encounter. We can help some of those missionaries when they come back. Some of these approaches over here, we can be training people in local countries how to deal with it, with the pressures that you encounter when you live in this particular part of the country off where they might be. How do you deal with the pressures and stresses? Stress, I've discovered, is a topic that's universal. That's prevention. We can give public lectures sometimes in other countries. And if you understand the language and the culture, it's better. And you can deal with some of the challenges that people have, criticizing missions. You can deal with some of the challenges that come against Christians in other countries. That's looking at the missions field. Now, I suggest that some of this stuff down here, which is a little more technical, the professionals may be more inclined to be working on that. I don't think we're training professionals very well in this area. I think we need to be doing more training. I think the pastors who speak every week are especially able to have an impact in the public field, although all of these people can. And I think peers, the lay people in the church, are the ones that often spot the problems before the problems develop, and they can often have a significant impact as preventive people helpers. Now, I think if we look at that picture and put this together into this kind of a circular picture, to me, this gives us a model. It gives us some direction in which we can go and gives us a way in which the church can have an impact. We don't have to stand back and say people are neglecting the church. Sure, they're maybe not coming to church. But that doesn't mean we fold up our hands and say, terrible, we're going to be buried by the next century. You know, some new research came out, and a man has just written a new book at home called The Frog in the Kettle. I have never tried this, but apparently if you put a frog in a kettle, put it over heat, because the frog's blood or whatever in its veins adapts to the outside environment. As the water gets warmer, so the frog's blood gets warmer, but eventually the water gets so hot the frog can't jump anymore and he perishes. And this article says the church is like a frog in a kettle. It's living in an environment that is changing, and sometimes we're just kind of not being aware of what's going on. We're not doing anything to jump out of the world situation in which we find ourselves, and we're kind of drifting along, and we're going to die before very long. And he makes some interesting projections about what the church is going to have to do. It's going to have to be more sensitive to music because the baby boomer generation is a music generation. And incidentally, baby boomers only exist in four countries in the world. The United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. Every other country in the world had an upsurge in the birth rate after the Second World War, and then it dropped after about 3 years. But in those four countries, it stayed up for a long time. And those young people have made an impact, and now they're reaching middle age, and some of them are frustrated. How are we going to reach these people? A lot of them are starting to go back to church because they're beginning to recognize that all of their career goals are not working out the way they'd hoped. And we've got to speak to those people and reach the music needs of those people. and see if we can deal with them where they have their struggles and their problems and their difficulties. And that gives us not something we stand back and say, isn't it awful that we don't have more people coming to church? To me, it gives us a marvelous opportunity. And to stand back and recognize that even anything as rigid sometimes as the field of psychology is beginning to recognize, maybe the church has got some things to contribute. Several years ago, O. Hobart Mauer, who was the president of the American Psychological Association, talked about the fact that we had psychology on one side and theology on the other, and there's a great wall in between. And he said it was interesting, the theologians in the early days of pastoral counseling came over the wall to see what psychology had to say. But he said, when they got over there, some of the psychologists began to recognize we don't have all the answers. And so they started to go back over the wall to see what the theologians had to say, and to their great surprise, they discovered that many of the theologians had left. And the only people who were there were the more conservative theologians. But he said they're beginning to recognize that this wall, it's still there, but it's disintegrating. And it seems to me that we have a wonderful opportunity to reach out to the psychological community, to reach out to people like this person who's hurting, to reach out to people in our communities who don't come to church. And I think it leaves us with a challenge. And that, I think, is something that we can be kind of excited about. So excited about it that we can stand up and take a brief break, not too long a break, then come back and answer the questions. And I want you to know that we only have 37 minutes before we have our afternoon tea.
I didn't go to afternoon tea. Can I say to you that after afternoon tea at 4 o'clock, we'll be commencing our workshop, and hopefully you will have put your name down for whatever workshop you're going to attend. Workshop, we'll tell you at the end of the session exactly where the workshops are going to be held, which one is going to be, and we'll introduce the speakers to you. Dr. Collins will now take questions on the session that we have just concluded, the role of church in counselling.
And I have a little fistful of cards here, too, that we can always rely on, too. Somebody asked me a question at the break. What's a baby boomer? Is that term not used widely here in Australia? It is used widely here in Australia. Okay, it's my understanding that after the Second World War, as I said, when all the men came back, and they started their, mostly men, I guess men and women who were involved in the Second World War, started their families. And like I said, that happened all over the world for that first two or three years afterwards. But in those four countries that I mentioned, it made an upsurge. And those people have really changed the whole course of the society as they move through it. And the oldest baby boomers, they're born, first ones are born about 1946. So the oldest baby boomers are what now? We're not to 96 yet. They're 45. See, they're moving into middle age, depending on how you define middle age. One of the things I've noticed as I've grown older and got a lot more wiser, I used to think middle age started when you were 30. Now I think middle age is, I really don't think you're middle age until you're well into your 60s. You know, middle age is 5 years beyond where you are. But in any case, these people are moving into their 40s and some of the struggles there, and they're discovering that many of them don't have as well as their parents did. And their parents were kind of in that moving, the group of people who, after the Second World War, worked hard, saw their careers develop and earned a lot of money and built houses and this kind of thing. And some of these kids haven't really, kids who are now in their, you know, in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s, now, boy, that dates me, the kids who are in their 40s. but some of these people have not really been able to have the freedom that that their parents had. There's a lot of frustration. They're discovering middle life crises and that kind of thing. And so, and people who write about the aging population and who talk about the fact that we're going to have a significant trend in elderly people, we'll talk about that tomorrow afternoon when we talk about the trends, but they say that you look at another 10 years, another say 25 years from now, or 35 years from now, going to be significant changes in the makeup of our population. Now, most of us will be up there too, But it's going to make a significant change, and that's going to have a lot of influence for counseling, for government programs, for social service programs, for medical programs, and the baby boomers are moving in that direction. So that's a significant impact. Okay, anybody have any questions, other questions about this afternoon? Anything you want to raise or observations you want to make about what was said this afternoon? Yes, sir. Go ahead. While he's coming, I reflect again. I appreciate you people. You, to sit in a warm room and fanning yourself and still be awake. And I know that's hard, and I really appreciate it. And usually I can see who's struggling. I can't think of anybody who is struggling. Some of you maybe hit it very well, but I appreciate that. Sir.
You mentioned earlier about how counseling is an important area for evangelism
yes.
in the future. And I was just thinking, in a local church, have you seen, or what can you say to us about models in which local churches have been involved in the full circle of all that? Perhaps had a Christian counsellor, perhaps in an office down the street, backed up by a pastoral care team in a church where these various things are happening, and some handles on like what you've seen, like in their clinic, say down the street, do they charge or not? Are they part of a pastoral team or are they separate? Like some ideas relating to implementing such a full program as that.
Excellent question that we could probably take quite a while to talk about and draw on the expertise of people here. Because there are people in this room who are involved in this kind of thing, certainly here in Australia and in this part of Australia, and can elaborate. And one or two of those people may want to add something later. I think we're seeing more and more of an interest in bringing counselors on the staff of a church or in somehow related to the staff of a church. I was told that about 3 or 4 years ago at home, many churches are hiring a pastor. If they pick up another staff member, it's usually somebody who works with youth. But if they pick up somebody else, it's not the Christian education director, it's somebody who's a counselor. A person who can work either in the church or outside of the church in meeting the counselor's needs. Now, you mentioned being down the street. Many times that's a better place to do it because people don't want to be people don't want to be seen going into the counselor down the street. And in that respect, to be in the church building, maybe it's less threatening. But on the other hand, if you're going into the church building to see the counselor and anybody sees you going in or going out of there, that can be threatening. I know of one large church where the church has a counseling center. It's actually on the church property, but the church property is large, and it's sort of around the corner from the main offices of the church and hidden with some bushes and some trees around there. So when people go in there, they're not seen going into the counselor. Not that there's anything to be ashamed of, but many people are reluctant to have it known that they're going in for that kind of help, especially people who might be leaders in the community or leaders in the church and want to be sensitive about rumors that sometimes get spread, unkind rumors, but nevertheless that happens. So many times to go down the street can be helpful. Now, a lot of people come from smaller churches. Most of the churches in Australia are smaller. And some, I suspect, struggle to maintain a pastor on the staff or a secretary on the staff. How can you possibly support a counselor? Well, sometimes churches work together to support a counselor. Or a denomination will support a counselor. And so you have different churches and maybe make a contribution to that person's salary. Now, in terms of fees, I think from what I realize, most of these counseling centers will charge some kind of fee. Somebody has suggested that there is no evidence, no empirical evidence to suggest that if you're getting counseling for free, that you don't work on that problem and that it's not worth anything. You can many times get counseling for free and you will still work on the problem if you're motivated and it will be very helpful. So the idea that if you're not paying for it, it's not working, there's no empirical basis for this. However, many times people feel that if you're getting counseling, just like if you're getting other kinds of services, you should pay for it. But I think most Christian counselors that I know of try to work on a sliding scale basis. And so if a person comes in and can pay the fees, they ask them to pay the fees. But if that person is not able to pay, needs the help but just can't pay, they work on a sliding scale. So depending on your income, you pay less and less. Counselors, incidentally, sometimes are accused of being money mad and taking too much money, and certainly some are. I don't deny that. But people who are in private practice that I have talked to have pointed out that it's expensive if you run a counseling office because you've got to pay the rent on the office and pay the overhead in terms of the electricity and that kind of thing. You have to pay the telephone. You have to pay for somebody to answer the phone on a 24-hour basis. You have to expect that if it rains, it doesn't snow here, but if you have bad weather or somebody gets sick and they don't come, then they don't pay and you don't get paid. At the same token, if you go away on a vacation or if you take a couple of days to come to a meeting like this, you don't get paid. And so you've got to make up for those times away by charging enough money when you are there. Furthermore, a lot of people don't pay. And so it's difficult sometimes to collect fees, and that costs expenses too. When you put it all together, professionals don't always make as much money as you might think. Many times a church will supplement the income of a professional or of a group of professionals and help them along the way. But I think the church can be doing this. This is apart from pastoral counseling. And I know that's done around here, and maybe one or two of you who are involved in this might want to address this question that was just asked. I think it's a good question. Yeah, go ahead, John.
I think the question is very central to where possibly we are at here in Brisbane. Just to say a bit of my experience, I've been working at Gateway Baptist, actually doing a couple of sessions a week in the church. The waiting room was actually the church building, and I practiced in the equivalent room out there. I don't think that was ideal. Nevertheless, I think on the longer term perspective, in negotiation with the church, we're looking at developing services there. And I think the first stage which we are considering, rather than services, is training. Mm-hmm. And actually getting the resources from the church. People who are already doing something, but maybe they need a bit more recognition, a bit more help to do that. But keeping it based within the local church. The idea is, this is the idea which I've shared with the senior pastors, is that gradually these people who are already doing the work perform a more formal function. They're released to do seminars or groups or whatever within the church or within the context of the church. And in doing so, they are actually equipping the saints to do the work of ministry. As time goes on, hopefully other people would come in from outside the church who've also got skills and participate. But also other people who want to be trained can come in from outside the church. This is very much in the early stages, but I think I guess what I'm trying to say is we're trying to practically address this issue, and I think it's very topical and pertinent to where Christian counseling services are in Brisbane at this time.
So John, you're doing work, you have a private practice in addition to what you do into the church, is that right?
That was in fact part of my private practice.
Okay.
As well as working with the government.
Okay, yes. So the idea of providing opportunities for that in-depth training, that's, counseling that's needed, but focusing a lot on the training.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's our first step is the training. I think looking at that primarily, and gradually then services hopefully will develop from that.
Good.
That's where we are at, I think.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate that.